Vine Pair's New York City headquarters, I'm Adam Teeter.
And I'm Joanna Sciarrino.
And in Seattle, Washington, I'm Zach Jabal.
And this is the Vine Pair podcast. You know, it's just...
It's March?
It's March.
Oh, it was already March on Friday.
Yeah, but I didn't really mark it, you know?
No, you didn't.
I didn't think about it. We didn't think about it. You know,
I meant to ask you guys on Friday, what is have you ever done anything memorable in your life on a February 29th?
No.
No.
Have you?
Oh. Yeah, I got my dog.
Oh.
Wow.
Eight years ago. I know. It was a coincidence. We weren't really
planning
on it.
Your dog's name is Willett, right?
Willett, yeah.
He is, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
It's a good dog name.
Mm-hmm.
It is a good. We weren't necessarily planning this when we adopted him, but he is very whiskey colored, and so we're like, and he had a truly horrible shelter name, and we were like, well, we can't stick with that. And so not to spend too much time on this, but when we were we went to the adoption, the shelter, and we were sort of like, they were like, okay, great. And we're like, what do you mean, okay, great? They're like, yeah, he's yours if you want him. And we're like, we thought we were going to, like, you know, meet him. Maybe, like, you do, like, some background checks or something. Because some of the other agencies we talked to, where there was, like, one of them had, like, a 10-page form you had to fill out that included, like, giving the cause of death of every pet you'd ever had. And I was like, I mean, I had a pet fish. It died of being a fish? I don't know. So we were like suddenly like, oh, well, we have like none of the things we need for a dog at home because we weren't really planning on coming home with a dog today. But if you give us an hour, we'll run to the pet store nearby.
Oh.
So on the drive over and back, we were like brainstorming and we just kind of were like going between a few. And Willett was the one that, you know, I'm just like driving, naming distilleries and brands and stuff. And we liked Willett. So yeah, Willett Ride Your
Ball. What was his rescue name?
Rickshaw.
Oh,
interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah,
so we were ready to get away from that.
Dijon?
Oh.
Yeah. His name was Dijon.
He does not look
like
a Dijon.
He's not a Dijon. He's a black dog. Anyway.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyways, Zach, what have you been drinking?
Yeah, sorry. I derailed this. Not Willett, although I guess I could be at any given moment. I always have it on hand because, you know, got to rep the dog at least. No, the most interesting thing for me was I had the opportunity to do something I do most years, which is go to a winery around here, Novelty Hill Jannick, and do a little blending demo or blending seminar. So, you know, the way it works is you show up, they give you like five different sort of barrel samples of in this case, the 2022 vintage of red. So Cabernet Sauvignon from two different sites on Red Mountain, and then Merlot, Malbec, and a Cabernet Franc. And you kind of get to play around with them, blend them in various configurations that you prefer. And then when you kind of land on the formula you like, you basically blend enough to make a bottle, and then they bottle it up for you, and you can open it at some point down the road, see how good you did. Yeah, and, you know, I've done it individually. I took some staff there when I was in the restaurant game, and I think it's just always a really instructive thing to kind of see, have a very, very small window into how complicated blending is, how dramatically it can change the finished wine based on even seemingly relatively small tweaks to the blend. And, you know, plus it's fun and you get a bottle of wine out of it. So yeah, that was kind of my highlight. I have I have not opened said bottle. And in fact, I've only, of the years I've done, I think I've only opened one of them so far. I've been a little afraid to face the music on whether my blends were any good. Cause it is a very, like, you do it in the moment, then you never
face
really
the music.
Do know. Yeah,
face
exactly. Okay. Well, I will keep you posted. Maybe I'll open one of them this week and I'll report back next week on the Monday pod.
Yeah.
So.
Cool.
Joanna, how about you?
Yeah, not too much recently, but I did have a few beers from Rupee Beer, which is a company that I've been wanting to try for a while. It's an Indian brewery, and I had their IPA, which is a little milder than a lot of the IPAs that we're used to, or that people like these days, I suppose, and a basmati rice lager that I really liked as well. And we published an article a few months or so ago about craft beer employing rice a little bit more in their brews. And yeah, anyway, I was curious and they were both really good. And then truly right before this podcast recording, I had the opportunity to have some Argiano Brunello di Montalcino. And that was really good too.
Nice.
Yeah. How about you, Adam?
So over this past weekend, I was home alone, watching Esty.
With Esty.
Yeah. And I opened a bottle of Forlorn Hope, Queen of the Sierra Red blend that was delicious.
Is that the bottle you posted?
Yes.
Yeah.
So winemaker in Napa, but making a lot of stuff in the Sierra foothills. Really interesting blends of reds. This is a chillable red wine.
It
Zach.
Looked like just a fun wine.
It's a chilled red wine. But it was really great. It was really like bright and refreshing. Lots of like rhubarb and strawberry. And it was just really tasty and went very well with the steak I made for myself since I could have a steak because anyone's not home. And then I had to go to Louisville earlier this past week for a bunch of meetings down there. And I went to this really amazing bar called Neat. Mm-hmm. Where all they do is, well, they do a lot more than this, but what they're known for is vintage bottles of bourbon, mm-hmm. mostly. They have some other whiskeys, too, but, you know, actually they feature very prominently in a book coming out by our writer, Aaron Goldfarb, called Dusty Booze, mm-hmm. yeah, Dusty Hunters. but they have a lot of Dusty Booze, and I had three pours. They pour you 1 ounce pours.
Okay.
That's the thing. And they're not super expensive, but they're not also cheap. They're like usually $20, $25 an ounce.
Okay.
So I had three of them because that was all I was going to do. But all really interesting. So the first that they poured me was Bourbon Deluxe, which was from 1977.
Sorry, you don't pick it.
No, I asked. I asked for some recommendations.
Okay.
And it was from... No, sorry. The Bourbon Deluxe was from 1991. Yeah, okay. 1991. And it was originally, this was a bottle that had made its way to Japan and then came back.
Okay.
Someone bought it mostly at auction. And it was made by a distillery that it does not exist anymore. It was really delicious. Then they poured me a bottle, a pour of Ancient Age, which is Old Buffalo Trace.
Okay.
That was 1977. That was amazing.
Wow.
And literally the bartender said to me, if you ever see Ancient Age, buy it. Mm-hmm. Basically, if you ever see a vintage bottle of Ancient Age, if you're at a garage sale and you see a closed bottle of Ancient Age, whatever, buy it. It does not exist anymore. And that was also Japanese. In terms of that it had been sent to Japan. So I think what a lot of people don't realize is that Japan really kept the bourbon industry afloat in the U.S. They kept buying bourbon when in the 70s and 80s we really didn't give a shit about it anymore. We were really interested in vodka and cordials.
A bit of a glut, too.
Yeah. There was so much, and the Japanese market kept buying bourbon. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the really great bourbon that's now back over in the U.S. has Japanese labeling on it, which is really cool.
Mm-hmm.
And then the final thing I had was a 1993 pour of Elijah Craig 12-year, which was also delicious.
Hmm.
And I've always liked Elijah Craig.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a lot of fun.
No birthier bourbon, though.
There didn't exist.
Oh.
They didn't have any of the bottles. Because they kept asking us, like, do you have any dates that are, you know,
meaningful.
Important to you, mm-hmm. meaningful to you? And it was interesting because... They had Lindsay's birth year, but she's younger than me, so awesome. It was a work trip. So I was with Lindsay, and they had her birth year, but they didn't have mine because I'm older than her. But I'm not as old as 77.
Yeah,
I just want to be very fucking clear.
Come on.
But they had her birth year.
Long-time listeners know how old you are.
Yeah.
it comes up.
What they offered her, which I thought was so interesting, cause at first I was like, this is a ripoff, but then they claimed it wasn't, was a bottle of Blanton's, a pour of Blanton's. And I was like, Blanton's? Like, haven't we all decided?
How old?
Like, 1990.
Okay.
But they said that actually that was still when like the brand, like basically it wasn't a cult and the brand was much more of a, it was considered to be like very important to the Buffalo Trace company. Like they really took great pride and care in it. There was a much more limited number that was made. Also apparently the wood was different then, he was explaining, because we didn't have so much over harvesting of wood, so like the wood was more mature that was used for the bourbon. So he's like, this was still when like the bourbon was really 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 really
special.
High quality and
yeah.
special. So and also I guess the grains were different because of where they were coming from, all this kind of stuff. So I don't know, Lindsay loved it.
What a cool thing.
Yeah, it was very cool.
Mm-hmm.
And it got me really wanting to try more vintage whiskeys. I thought it was a very cool idea. So this week we have a listener question, and that question comes from Adam out of Los Angeles. Great fucking name, Adam. Just great name. And he called in and left us, well, sent a voicemail in and left us a question. So, Zach, why don't you play it?
Hi, Joanna, Adam, and Zach. Thanks for all you do on the pod. I was thinking about your latest episode about does anyone know how to sell wine? And I know you guys have talked a lot about the dwindling by the glass menus at restaurants and how why bottles are so expensive on restaurant wine lists. But I was thinking about it, and I find myself gravitating a lot more towards the same couple of wine bars here in LA that have long by the glass menus or even offer half glass pours for a reduced price. And I just never really like see myself ever ordering $100 to $200 bottles of wine at a restaurant. But when I do this and I go out and have like several by the glasses or whatever, like the price is usually $100 to $200 and it does not bother me at all. And I think it's just because I'm getting more bang for buck as far as like getting to explore more wine. Do you guys see any shot of a resurgence of the by the glass menu? Or do you think restaurants and winemakers would be willing to kind of like make less per bottle, but more in the long game with it by having more opportunities for this kind of stuff that's a little bit more friendly to the people actually dining at the restaurants or at the wine bars? Thanks for all you do. Hope you're having a good day.
All right, Adam.
Thanks, Adam.
All right, Adam. Yeah. What a great question. Who wants to tackle it first? Zach.
Well, you know, it's actually really interesting. When you were talking about your tasting experience in Louisville, I was thinking about this question, knowing it'd be coming up and how, you know, you were talking about how for you, this opportunity to try these 1 ounce pours, yeah. Even if it's a, you know, slightly smaller pour than you might typically expect getting whiskey neat. And obviously with, you know, a decent price tag, not a crazy price tag attached to it. And how, you know, Adam points out that like, for him, the price is only part of the consideration, and that with these wine bars and the buy the glass with buy the glass programs, part of the sort of interesting piece of it is, you know, being able to try different things, having a more, you know, kind of, I don't want to say complex experience, but just a more varied experience with wine in a night out, as opposed to one or two bottles. And, you know, I think that there are for sure a lot of people who feel this way, especially on the consumer side, right? I think lots of people enjoy the opportunity, especially if you're going out for sort of to a wine bar or to a restaurant with a large by the glass program, that the ability to try a few different wines is welcome in a lot of these cases. And I think there are places that do a really good job of this. I don't know that as many people as Adam, or I don't know if how many other people besides Adam are super okay with the cost that goes along with that. I mean, I think we've talked on the pod before, one of the challenges with by the glass programs and why they've been in a lot of cases shrinking is because consumers find it hard to kind of consider the value in a 5 ounce pour of wine priced the same as a craft cocktail. That is for a lot of drinkers, that is a more difficult, it's just a less compelling proposition than a less expensive glass pour might be, and bottles feel like a little bit better value because you're usually paying a lower margin. So I mean, I don't know, I kind of want to come back to this or say more about this once you two have had a chance to talk, because I think, you know, the two of you probably have a slightly different perspective, because I, when I hear questions like this, can't kind of help but think about margins and what I would do and cost and stuff like that. And, you know, Adam's really coming at it from a consumer perspective, which is great, but I don't know what, Joanna, how do you feel about this?
Yeah, I have to agree that, you know, he mentions that he usually shies away from buying bottles, but is willing to spend the same amount, if not whatever, same amount on glass pours. But I think for a lot of people, they can't justify multiple glass pours, or don't often justify multiple glass pours. They're always going to say, well, if we're going to have, you know, a couple of rounds of glasses, we might as well just get a bottle. And I think that's where people end up thinking the value is. And it's true, right? It is, right? Because that the glass pours are where they, well, I guess the markup is always going to give them the most favorable margins, right? I think, you know, Adam puts it to us like, would restaurants and winemakers be more willing to make less per bottle but sell a lot more in a more patron-friendly way? And I don't know. I don't think they would necessarily be willing to do that, even if it meant more people drinking wine by the glass.
Yeah, I mean, I think, so there's a bunch of points to make here. One, I think it's a beautiful idea, but I think it is very difficult for most places. For me, where this makes sense is this is potentially what the purpose of the quintessential ideal wine bar is, mm-hmm. right? That like it's at a very specific wine bar that's not a fucking wine bar, that's actually a restaurant. but an actual wine bar where there's more seats probably at the bar than there are at tables with service and appetizers and entrees and dessert, where you should expect to have lots of bottles open that can be sampled and tried throughout the course of an evening. Now, how many of those types of bars can one market sustain? It depends on the market size and the demand, right? So I would say New York should be able to sustain quite a few of these types of bars. But I would argue that other markets maybe can sustain one or two. But does every market – and Adam says he has a few places he likes to go to. Let's be honest and say he's in Los Angeles. But, you know, I think that – we in New York could probably sustain one in every major wine-interested neighborhood, right? So I think Lower East Side could have one of these, the East Village, my neighborhood of Fort Greene, Williamsburg, Carroll Gardens, etc. A lot of the places that pretend to be those now really are restaurants, which is very frustrating. But that's what those places, I think, ideally should be. But having a lot of bottles open is very expensive. If the bottles don't get sold through very quickly, then the wine goes bad. A lot of the preservation systems don't fucking work. We've had these conversations before. A lot of people don't truly believe Coravin works and have had bad experiences with it, including members of this podcast, including myself and Zach. Yeah.
Wine's on tap.
Yeah, a lot of people. Wine's on tap is the only way to do it, but it's really unsexy, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, wine's on tap, those machines – like, I mean, there's a place in Healdsburg that I went to that does that on their ground floor. I forget the restaurant's name. It's on the square in California and in Sonoma, but in Healdsburg, but mm-hmm. In Sonoma. And the machines are all around the restaurant. They, like, encourage you to get up. But it looks ugly. I mean, it looks like you're – honestly, it looks like you're like a gas station or something. They're, like, brightly colored. They have metal nozzles coming out of them. Like, it just kind of looks like you are at a McDonald's, but it's wine coming out of it instead of Coca-Cola. Like, they're just not beautiful. And I don't think that works in a lot of these settings where everyone – they're trying to keep it dark and sexy and fun, all that kind of stuff. So then you have, the kind of models where, like, they strip the air out and they actually have the pumps, not the manual one, but, like, literally it's like, you know, an air hose thing that pulls it out. I think Keith's had one at his restaurant 10 years ago. And again, that doesn't really work. Most people say, like, I mean, people think it strips the wine of aromas and all that shit. So having all these wines open is very expensive because there's just so much opportunity to lose money. So that's why I think people have focus lists with the wines that they know move. And that is a problem for people who are trying to explore, because the wines that people know move are usually wines that are what they should be, which is what most people fucking want to drink, right? Yeah. It's like, you know, the light refreshing red, a rosé, a big red, a crisp white, like, and most and often, depending on where you are, if the operator is smart, it is wines that are grapes. We all know that there's a Cab on the list, there's a Pinot Noir, you know, there's a Savvy B, there's a Chardonnay, like, and that's not where you're going to encounter and learn about obscure wines, right? That should be what this geeky wine bar is for, but again, they have to be willing to sort of absorb that cost. On the point of the you know, the producers, importers being willing to take more money, like, it's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, every single place is margin obsessed and taking as much margin as possible. It's actually really funny. I was at a very large alcohol company recently, walking through the office after doing some meetings and listening to some of their employees complain about having gone out over the weekend and how expensive the drinks were that they had had. And I'm thinking, that's so funny because I just come from a meeting where your boss was talking about margin and how they take more. Yeah. So, like, it's everyone's to blame in this, right? Like, even the people who are selling the alcohol don't want to pay that much when they go out, but, like, then when their numbers are being analyzed, they're being asked to get as much margin as possible and to grow the business. So, like, it's just, I don't think it's ever going to happen that, like, the alcohol company's like, you know what, we're willing to basically break even or take a loss in order to, like, allow you to drink more cheaply or for this to happen. I just don't think that's ever going to happen, because they're going to say my competitors aren't going to do that. So, like, why should I? So I think that's a really difficult proposition for most people to consider.
Well, I think also the concept that you're putting out there, right, where a number of great bottles are open at once, like, it's so costly, and they can't even guarantee that people are going to come in and drink.
Exactly.
Like, you have to have a really, really dedicated, guaranteed group of people who are going to come to your establishment to sustain it, right, and to justify having, like, that people are going to come and drink those bottles, right? And we're having this issue where, whatever, I can't, it's a refrain, I can't hear it anymore. Like, younger people don't want to drink wine anymore, right? So if you're not going to get those people, it's not guaranteed that they're going to come in, why would you why would you spend that much money on that type of concept?
I mean, all I could say to someone like Adam, who has the desire to explore and learn, is like, I think the best thing you can actually do is become a regular.
Yeah.
Like, so that's great that you have a lot of places you want to go, but actually, like, you know, early days, the way that I learned a lot about wine was I became a regular at Invino. And so when Keith just had stuff open, he would pour me splashes.
Yep.
And
this is what happened every scene for us, too.
Exactly.
Yep.
You know, and now Keith winds up working at Vine Pair. It's great. Everyone wins. But, like, you know, I think that that is the best way if you're really into wine. I think actually, like, hopping from place to place to place is not a great way because you're just going to be at the whims of whatever's on their list that night. They don't know who you are. They don't know why you're trying to drink a bunch of different bottles, why like, what you're out there to explore. Instead, go get a rapport with people. You'll get to try a bunch of stuff. Look, that's the same advice that's been I've heard given to people who are like getting into whiskey, like Travel Bar in Brooklyn. People say become a regular there, and ultimately you'll get to try really cool stuff because they'll get to know you. You support them, and then like they'll just happen to be like, "Hey, yeah, we know you're never going to buy this, but if you ever want to taste what X, Y, or Z tastes like, here's a small splash."
Yeah,
that's my best advice because otherwise I just don't see the economic model for most people where this works anymore.
I think the other piece of this, you know, we talk about the cost of the bottles and waste and stuff like that, but, you know, if you're building a wine program with a lot of these sort of less familiar wines, you're trying to develop a following, you're trying to get people in the door, it's also labor intensive, it's staff intensive. You have to have people who know what they're doing. You know, we've talked plenty on the pod about the sort of ongoing challenge of finding wine professionals who are both knowledgeable and aren't kind of shitty to guests and all this kind of stuff. And like, you know, Adam, you talked about the places and why there's this incentive to just kind of keep giving people the product that they're familiar with and that they want. And I think a lot of it is exactly that, that there's just, it's not just a, oh, well, we might open a bottle of wine and only sell two glasses out of it. That in the end, yeah, that's not great, but there are like, there are solutions to that problem, but it's more like we might also pay people to work for a shift and not do enough business to pay them. That's a bigger problem. And you need more experienced staff. You need better, I mean, you need people who know what they're talking about, which comes from a lot of different ways, but at least experience is one of them. And without any real guarantee that there'll be return on investment, because in the end, like you said, at best, big cities with large sort of populations can support a few of these places. And how are you to know if you're looking to open one or you're looking to change concepts that you're going to be the one that thrives? I mean, you can have faith. You can believe people do open these places from time to time, and they either occasionally succeed. More often, they either fail outright or they become a restaurant and maybe have success like that. But I just, you know, it's like one of these things where it's like, I have a lot of sympathy for Adam, and I appreciate his question, and I think there's a lot there, but it's kind of one of these things where it's like, well, why don't people open businesses that give me what I want and aren't profitable? And it's like, well, I mean, you kind of answered your question, right? Yeah. Like, in the end, very few people, even people who are passionate about wine or anything, open a business with the hopes that it's not going to make the money. Like, they want the intention is to maybe both do something that they're passionate about and to make money. But if it doesn't do the second one of those things, the passion, unless you have a lot of money from somewhere else, just can't sustain a business for long. And, you know, the hospitality industry is particularly ruthless in that regard because you have a ton of overhead tied up in whatever you're doing, whether it's food, drink, etc. And it doesn't take very long. It doesn't take very much, you know, kind of, it doesn't take a downturn or just slow nights or whatever. It doesn't take very many of those to kill your business, unless you're extremely, you know, you, like I said, you have a lot of wealth behind you in one way or another. And the, yeah, it's just the truth that it's hard to count on those kind of places to cater to the relatively small percentage of people who want to kind of be a wine dilettante. It's just, the truth is they're just, it's, they're not enough of them. And they don't want to spend a lot of money, or they, the, you know, the truth is that people want to spend a lot of money on wine, want the same wine they've always wanted. You know, the prestige stuff, the high-end stuff, the well-known stuff, the brand name stuff. And, you know, you honestly have probably a better, candidly, you probably have a better business model opening a wine bar that's centered around that stuff than around the esoterica, the novel, all of that. Because in the end, like, it's really hard to keep that going.
Yeah, I had a conversation with Dave Foss recently. He was talking about By the Glass lists and how putting together a really interesting By the Glass list is actually quite, like, the wine, those types of wines are expensive.
Yeah.
And And yeah, like Zach said, it's you're probably going to be more successful putting together or having a concept that has the wines that everybody wants where you know you can sell them.
Yeah. I think the other thing to think about is like going back to my point about this having to be a wine bar that does this, if it's anything, is that when it comes to a restaurant, right, there's for the most part, when you're thinking about by the glass, the by the glass section of a menu lives on the opposite side of the paper that you were handed with the food, right? Mm-hmm. So the appetizers, the salads, the soups, the entrees and are all on one side of the piece of paper when they drop the menu for you. You turn the paper over and there's by the glass and cocktails, right?
Yeah.
And if cocktails are selling, why are you going to have a more by the glass program? Because you're losing, you're then stealing real estate from the cocktails to add more wines to list. And most places don't want to do that because right now cocktails sell.
Yeah.
And people are willing to spend $20 on average on a cocktail right now. That is what we are seeing across the board. I just listened to the Cocktail College. Tim did this week about the vodka martini. And like that is what the guest is talking about. Like you're seeing $20 cocktails almost everywhere around the country now.
Yep.
And for even for the vodka martini, yep. Right, which is a drink that a lot of people bemoan and other people love. And so if that's the case – and people are willing to see all the different variations of martinis and Negronis and et cetera, why would you ever take two of those drinks away that are probably much more guaranteed sellers in order to add two more glasses of wine?
You're just and not more to the point.
That's a good point.
Those that vodka martini is going to generate you much
more,
higher margin
way more.
Than – than even a – because the thing is, like, if you think about what could get people to shell out $20 for a glass of wine, it's probably got to be a recognizable variety, a recognizable producer, a recognizable region. Like, a glass of Sancerre, you might be able to sell it for $20, probably in a lot of places.
Yep.
But the truth is that whatever margin you're getting on a bottle of – on that glass pour of Sancerre is less than your house vodka martini. And in the end, like, restaurants just, like – are not the kind of businesses that can afford to some extent to make the to opt for the lower margin item over and over again. They have to do some of it. They have to offer, you know, they probably aren't very many restaurants that can get away with only offering you the highest margin food and drink. I mean, that's the way it works. Yeah. You've got to have the right product mix. But in the end, you're right. You're not going to take time, energy, real estate, or just consumer attention away from the stuff that makes you the money.
No, you're going to keep on the list what sells. And I think at most of these places, what sells right now, and there's another podcast episode we're going to obviously do very soon about why we think it is cocktails or what happened to wine or things like that. But like, mm-hmm. It's going to be cocktails. And just one story that I think really, articulates this that has nothing to do with wine, but is that there is a pretty prominent, I don't think it's not a chain, but it is. It's a brewery with a few locations in New York City mm-hmm. that I was told recently added to one of their locations a espresso martini. They're a brewery. They sell beer.
Do they have cocktails?
Yes. They are allowed to because of licensing,
so
et cetera.
Like they have one cocktail and it's an espresso
martini. No, but they added an espresso martini.
Okay.
Just to this location.
Okay.
The espresso martini quickly became the most sold drink.
At the brewery.
Oh, my God. Especially on the weekends.
Sure.
So what did they fucking do? They added it to every location.
Yeah.
Because that's what people wanted to drink. Even at the brewery where they are brewing beer, people on the weekends are ordering espresso martinis at a fucking brewery.
Sure.
So again, why are you as the restaurant going to take off the espresso martini to add a glass of wine?
Mm-hmm.
You're just not. And so therefore, I think, Adam, what we need is we need to hope, again, that there are some wine bars, some people that truly love wine so much that they will do this for you. Or, my brother, you got to just become a regular at one of these places you like.
Keep going there.
And keep going and keep supporting them, and they will open awesome stuff for you. They will.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if people who own bars and restaurants that are successful are good at hospitality.
Yeah.
For the most part.
Yeah.
And so they will figure it out, and they will offer you. You'll become friends with them. That's the best way, dude. But, like... I think that by the glass for now is always going to be a much smaller part of the list than a lot of people hope it would be, including winemakers.
Oh, for sure.
Let us know what you think. Hit us up at podcast@vinepair.com. And if you ever have a question like this, send us a voice memo. Record it. If you're unsure if the question's good, email it first and one of us will write back to you and say, hey, it's a great question. We'd love to cover it. Then record the voice memo and send it to us. But this has been a lot of fun. We like doing this. So, send it in to us. And Joanna and Zach, I'll talk to you on Friday.
Have a nice week.
Sounds great.
Thanks so much for listening to the Vine Pair Podcast, the flagship podcast of the Vine Pair Podcast Network. If you love listening to this show, or even if you don't, but I really hope that you do, as much as we really do love making it, then please drop us a review or a rating wherever it is that you get your podcast, whether that be iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, anywhere. If you are listening to this on a device right now, through an app, however you got this audio, please drop a review. It really helps everyone else discover the show. And now for some totally awesome credits. So, the Vine Pair Podcast is recorded in our New York City headquarters and in Seattle, Washington, in Zach Jabal's basement. It is recorded by Zach, mastered, and produced by Zach. He loves all the credit. Keep giving it to him. Drop his name in the reviews. He's going to love hearing how much you love him. It is also recorded in New York City by our tastings director, Keith Beavers, who is the managing director of the entire Vine Pair Podcast Network. I'd also love to give a shout out to our editor-in-chief, Joanna Sherino, who joins us on every single podcast as our third and most important host. Thank you as well to the entire Vine Pair staff and everyone who's been involved in making Vine Pair as special as it's become. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next week.